Live from the Ken and Valerie Baker Studio at WHYY, this is Studio 2.
On Monday, July 20th, welcome, 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 friends, on Into the Program. I'm Cherry Gregg.
I'm Avi Wolfman. Aaron, congratulations to the great nation of Spain on World Cup victory yesterday. Argentina, one of the most disgraceful, cynical performances I've ever seen in a major athletic competition. I'm glad they lost. I'm happy for Spain. They're deserved champions of the world. That's my take on one of the headlines of the day, Cherry.
All right.
A strong take.
Yeah, I watched the second half and then the 30 extra minutes.
Who are you rooting for?
You know, I Lamine Yamal. Like, I wanted the next generation, the handoff.
Spain. Spain.
I was rooting for the next generation to win. But it was, you know, I was like waiting for something to happen, you know? Those goalies were great, by the way.
I don't even like soccer enough, and I didn't realize I could hate a soccer team as much as I hated watching Argentina in that game.
Oh, why did you hate them so much?
They were dirty. The whole game, dirty.
Yeah, they got a red card
at the
end.
Dirty, and just playing to get it to penalty kicks.
Mm-hmm.
Horrible display. Well, but congratulations again to Spain.
Go Spain!
Again, that's my take on one of the big headlines of the day. Mm-hmm. We're going to get some other takes on some other major headlines in the main part of the show today. That's probably the last major opinion you'll hear from me, thankfully.
Mm-hmm.
But we will hear from a couple of pundits on some of the big headlines around the world and around the country in our main segment today. It's a little political roundtable.
A lot to talk about.
We'll talk about, of course, Iran. We'll talk about the politics around that war. We'll talk about some domestic politics that are dividing the Democratic Party. We'll talk about election security. We'll talk about immigration enforcement. Of course, we'd love to hear from you. What story are you following most closely and why? Give us a call, 888-477-9499, email studio2@whyy.org, YouTube, Facebook. Leave a comment in the live chat.
Yeah, wonder what folks have been paying attention to. Like you said, so much going on, so 888-477-9499.
We don't have to pay attention to Argentina anymore,
yeah,
thank God.
Studio2@whyy.org. And by the way, we missed you guys. We were not live last week. We had our Big Fix series playing, but we look forward to you calling in this
We'd love
week.
To hear from
yeah,
you.
Yeah, for sure. So we have our trio of local news stories.
Go ahead, Jerry.
And you kicked it off with the FIFA World Cup. Well, it came to an end last night in New Jersey. As Avi said, Spain won the trophy over Argentina, won the zip in extra time. And it turns out this World Cup was the largest, most expensive, and most well-attended World Cup ever. Mm. Okay. And for the past several weeks, Philadelphia has been on the world stage. We hosted 6 World Cup matches and our very own FIFA Fan Fest on Lemon Hill. And our local official said, guess what? The city nailed it. According to organizers, more than 500,000 people attended Fan Fest, with fans consuming more than 290,000 beers, 55,000
hot dogs. Less than a beer per person. I would not have predicted that.
And 46,000 soft pretzels. Well, a lot of kids were there, you know,
that's
people
true.
Under 18, and it was hot, so there it is.
That's true. Fair point.
And then when we look at the games, Philly saw more than 410,000 people at its World Cup matches. Not bad, right? And according to Philly Voice, the big winners are SEPTA, which saw ridership increases, sports bars stayed busy, and Lemon Hill, of course, was the hot spot. The downside was parking was a chore in the Fairmount neighborhoods, and smaller businesses over there suffered. Well, all in all, you know, positive reviews of the World Cup in Philly. Over the bridge in New Jersey, they hosted 8 matches, including last night's final. Governor Mikey Sherrill attended 7 games, but she is crying foul. She took the organization to task for trying to sell the turf or grass from last night's game for $450 a square. And if you look on StubHub, the price is up to $3,000. And FIFA stands to make about $11.2 million from selling the turf. And the governor said, look, Jersey should get a cut because, you know, taxpayers did pay for the field. Hello. She says Jersey taxpayers took on a lot of the costs, while FIFA has kept a lot of the profits. At the same time, Governor Sherrill, she said she enjoyed having, you know, the World Cup there in New Jersey. And she told Politico that she would support New Jersey hosting the World Cup again in 4 years, if that's what they wanted to do, or ever again.
Well,
so,
I think they've already picked where they're going to have
it again
in 4 years.
They said, well, and again. So again.
Sometime in the future.
Sometime in the future. So there you go.
I didn't even know. I guess if you buy the grass, how do you keep it from browning. Either way, that's neither
here nor there. I don't know, but soak it in something. I don't know.
Yeah, like the way you keep basil going in your kitchen, you know, put it in a little jar or something.
But $450 for a little block.
But it's emblematic, right, of the way people view FIFA. But look, the reason FIFA can do this is because this event is like no other, and truly it felt like
that. People were willing to pay for it, yeah.
And it felt like that for the whole stretch where FIFA was here in America and where the FIFA Fan Fest was here in Philly. I mean, nothing brings people together.
Yeah.
Like that event. You could feel it through the city.
You had me watching soccer. I mean, come on. Me watching. Everybody was watching.
It was mesmerizing. And it's just another reminder that what people really want is to be with other people, to be in community with other people. And there were so many beautiful scenes of that. And so, yes, there were some downsides, but the upsides were also tremendous. I also think, you know, Philly's making a nice, strong case for itself as a big event city. And, you know, putting it up itself up there with New York and with D.C., saying we're not just a pass through. This is a place for international events.
Yeah.
And I think they, you know, overall, it seems like the impressions were positive.
And let me tell you, because the city seemed cleaner. You know what I mean? Like, I was walking around. I was like, wow. And it made me appreciate Philadelphia a lot more because all the social media was so positive from the fans that came to the city.
Yeah.
And it made me want to just, you know, be more grateful for the city that we live in. It's great.
Which is why people end up paying the extortion fees to FIFA, right? Because it's nothing like it. I mean, that's the leverage play. And it all comes back.
Mm-hmm.
To leverage. Story number two. Abington Township in Montgomery County has a problem.
Oh.
A goose problem.
Oof.
Dum, dum, dum. Or should I say?
Quack, quack.
Honk, honk, honk. Exactly.
Mm-hmm.
Interesting story in the Inquirer about Abington signing a contract with the U.S. Department of Agriculture to do goose abatement in one of its parks, which has apparently been overrun with Canada geese. The abatement methods include lasers to bother the geese.
Mm-hmm.
If that doesn't work, pyrotechnic noisemakers, perhaps destroying goose eggs, and possibly even killing geese. If it gets to that, geese may seem innocent, but they're actually a big problem in suburbs really all over the continent. They can be aggressive towards humans. Their poop can damage the environment. They poop quite a bit, apparently.
Mm-hmm.
Abington has been dealing with goose overpopulation since the 1980s, four decades of this. And really, this whole story is actually a reflection of how we build our suburbs, Jerry, because geese really thrive in large grassy areas near water, and suburbs are full of lawns and grassy areas and fake lakes and golf courses.
Gotta have a fake lake.
Exactly. It's sort of it's a goose garden of Eden. And so, you know, no,
it is a reflection
of how the way we manipulate our environments also has a huge ecological impact. And so now there's this goose overpopulation in Abington and many other places.
Yeah. I have to tell you, if a gaggle of geese comes for me, I'm running.
No, they are a bit scary.
Yeah,
that's no joke.
I'm serious. Like, I went to a park once. It was in the burbs, and they were everywhere. And they can be a little scary.
And they attacked you?
No, they didn't attack me. But I'm just saying that in a group,
I didn't know where that story was going. Yeah, fair enough.
So, but I had no idea that Bucks County's Falls Townships, they spend $17,000 a year to chase geese away with dogs. But I was wondering, like, where are they chasing them? Like, you know, they just want them out the area? Like,
yeah, just to the next town,
I guess.
To
the next town, and then they
have to deal with them. Well, because a lot of these geese, apparently, according to the Inquirer article, are no longer even migratory. So there are geese that, like, migrate from Canada down south and back every year, right? There are migratory geese. But apparently a lot of the geese now just camp out and stay here all year. And geese used to be, you know, threatened. But now they've boomed way back the other way. They're kind of the same way deer have kind of gone crazy in some
places.
They
got real comfortable in the suburbs.
So just the way we build our environments has such a big impact. And this is just it's a reminder of that.
Yeah, geese garden of Eden. Love that phrase. Third story, a uniquely Philly competition is about to go down. It's the Philadelphia Parallel Parking Championship. Yeah, shout out to Philly Mag's Victor Fiorello for this one. It's being put on by the Philadelphia Parallel Parking Association, or the PPPA, for the purpose of celebrating the ability to quickly wedge a car into the tightest of spaces in the city under the most immense pressure, like traffic, e-bikes flying by, horns honking, people yelling, people staring at you. while you get it done.
Staring is kind of the worst. Low key.
Oh my gosh. People staring like on the stoops the looking shaming. At you. Oh the my gosh. Because you can't bad. Get it done. That's crazy. And so the PPPA claims they're doing this a public service because excellence in parallel parking means more parking for all.
True.
Right?
True.
And so they're calling for applicants to tell them why they should compete. There are three categories for the winners. One shot, tight squeeze, and under duress. And you'll be judged on your pronouncements, how you announce the turn, put your blinker on,
yep.
your performance, whether how many turns it takes you to get into the space,
yeah.
and then placement. Make sure you don't leave a whole lot
yeah,
of space.
Close to the curb.
Yeah, close yeah. to the curb, all that. So you could sign up at fillaparallelparking.org/championship. Are you any good?
I'm okay. I would not enter myself as a potential champion. Or do you think you're good?
I think I'm good, but I will tell you that when I first moved to Philly, like I caved under the pressure and a neighbor had to parallel park my car because I lived in South
wow.
Philly. There was a bus behind me. They were tooting a horn.
But you were forged in fire and now you're great.
I've been forged in fire. Yeah, yeah. By Philly fire.
Can I just say real quick?
Yeah.
I love this idea. I do think eventually we need divisions the way they have like in boxing. Like the big boys got to go against the big boys, like the trucks versus the trucks. And
oh,
if you have an advanced backup camera with the little lines,
disable that sucker. No.
I can't be competing against you. That's
no,
not fair.
No, that's tech. Yeah.
That's tech.
I do use the tech.
So we need divisions eventually.
So
but this first year will be a great start.
Oh, and we're talking politics on the other side of this break. We'll be right back.
And welcome back to Studio 2 on WHYY. I'm Avi Wolfman-Aaron.
And I'm Cherry Gregg. Today, we're talking about all the major headlines at home and abroad. We'll get into elections and President Trump's election security concerns, high-profile shootings at the hands of ICE, and of course, the big story today, Iran.
In less than 2 weeks since peace talks broke down, the U.S. has tried to wrest control over the Strait of Hormuz using naval blockades and nightly airstrikes, and the deaths of three U.S. troops over the weekend seem only to have fanned the flames.
Yeah, joining us in studio are two commentators from either side of the aisle. Mustafa Rashid is the president and CEO of Bellevue Strategies. Mustafa, welcome back to Studio 2.
Thank you and happy to be here. Good afternoon.
Also joining us is Terry Tracy, founder of Broad and Liberty and CEO of Fideri News Network. Welcome back to the show, Terry.
Happy to be back. Good to see you guys.
Yes. And for you, our listeners at home, on the road, or elsewhere, our question of the day is, what story are you following most closely and why? Give us a call. The number is 888-477-9499. The email is studio2@whyy.org. And for our YouTube or Facebookers, hello. You can leave your comments in the live chat.
And we'll start with the latest from the war with Iran. American fatalities have climbed to 17. Two service members recently killed in Jordan, a third in northern Iraq. Mustafa, are you surprised we are still here, engaged in hostilities with Iran? When this conflict started, at the very, very end of February, we heard from the administration that this would be a relatively quick yeah. engagement.
Yeah, absolutely. First and foremost, I want to say thank you to those service members who paid the ultimate sacrifice for their country. I know how tough that is for their families. And so our thoughts and prayers to them at this time, just not just them, but all the service members who are in harm's way over in that part of the world right now. At the time that this war started, and now we're, I think there's no qualms about it, we're certainly calling it a war, it was supposed to be a quick in and out kind of engagement. And that has not been the case. And I still think that the reason for this is unclear to most Americans. And so it's confusing. It's, why are we doing this? Is causing our gas prices to be high? Is this making us safer for our place in the world? And I don't think those questions are being answered right now. It just raises more questions about what is it we're doing and why we're doing it over in that part of the world.
Terry, are you surprised we're here?
First, I want to echo those sentiments because they're spot on. I'm not surprised, only because when we were talking about, I remember having this conversation with you guys in February, and the one thing, while I supported the action overall, I think the one thing that we discussed as being sort of what we had to keep our eyes on was how the administration was managing expectations and defining what success ultimately looked like, you know, because in the previous operation, it was about taking out nuclear capacity. And so, you know, airstrikes can do that. You can go in, you can bomb the facilities, presumably you take out or at least mitigate the risk. This is different because it seems like the objective is regime change. And ultimately, that's what's required. That was not – and I, if one were to assume that regime change in Iran would be as quick and painless as regime change in Venezuela, one's likely to be disappointed. So – and I think that's where we are here. And I think that I think it's incumbent upon the administration sort of to define success and then allocate resources necessary in order to achieve it. Ultimately, just one last point and then I'll stop. I think that you have to give the president some credit for trying to come to a negotiated peace or a negotiated settlement. Peace is probably unlikely, but a negotiated settlement. And that's why the time has sort of dragged on the way it has, and he's sort of negotiating publicly and we don't know what's going on. But I think it's less about the time and ultimately about the outcome.
Yeah. And some have called this a war of choice, you know, Terry. And I want from both of you, when does this stop becoming, you know, or being viewed as a public policy or foreign policy issue and really be viewed as a kitchen table issue? Because, and I say this because I went to fill up my tank yesterday. Yeah. Yep. And it was $4.19 per gallon.
That's correct.
And yep. Mustafa, I'll start with you.
Yeah, it absolutely is. You know, one of the frustrating things about this, and this is not unique to President Trump's administration, is the last three or four administrations have learned nothing about what it is to do conflict in that part of the world. It's intractable. They don't understand the issues. They don't understand how deep-seated some of the conflicts are, and that you think that you can come in and do either regime change or implement your versions of peace. And we've learned nothing from Iraq. We've learned nothing from Afghanistan over the last 25 years. And that part's frustrating. That part doesn't seem to be working. Whereas Americans here at home are feeling the impact of it. They're feeling higher gas prices. They're feeling less secure and safe in their place in the world. And it just doesn't make sense to the average American why we still continue to do this.
Yeah, and when does it cross the line and really stop being a foreign, you know, policy issue, and it's really kitchen table, and we're months from midterms.
Yeah, I mean, I sort of see that as a distinction without a difference. I mean, foreign policy always has huge implications for kitchen table issues, be they, you know, military policy, monetary policy, you know, tariffs, all these things obviously affect what happens on the domestic front. I think that look, the reality is that this is – I don't know how you do this without boots on the ground. I just don't know how you get to an end game without boots. I, as powerful as our Navy and our Air Force are – and look, I think, you know, taking out public infrastructure is going to weaken them even further. But ultimately, to get to a conclusion – I don't know how you do this without some kind of occupying force, whether those American troops, whether it's a multinational effort. I just don't see how you get there. And I think that that's the challenge, because President Trump is loath to do that, has always been against that kind of interventionist foreign policy. And I made this point a few months ago. None of us saw the intelligence. I think that there was a real imminent threat that made him feel like his hand was forced on this issue, because this is not his – this is not his natural impulse to do this kind of thing. I think he felt like that it was the right thing to do to keep the American people safe, and the American people are safer as a result of the action. But in terms of cleaning up the mess over there, it's a different story.
It's going to get more expensive. That's your prediction.
Yeah, and the expensive part to kitchen table issues is the cost. I mean, the president's asking for $50 billion more to fund this war. At the same time where Americans are looking at how much things are costing for them every day, the expensive, the rising cost of healthcare. So on one hand, we say we can't afford to extend healthcare subsidies, but we can't afford to do as long engagement in war. I think people are making that connection and it's not making sense to them.
The one thing I'll say to that is, you know, defense innovation, defense, the economic impact of national defense-related production can actually help us economically. I mean, getting back to producing ships, the president's talking a lot about this right now, producing ships domestically, producing submarines domestically, producing chips domestically. I mean, we saw this in World War II. If the nation wanted to mobilize around national defense spending and infrastructure, there could actually be the kind of economic benefit to the country. It's not necessarily because we go to war overseas, therefore there is a adverse or negative impact on the American people economically at home. The president inherited an economic mess. Taking this action without necessarily connecting the dots between those two realities can cause political problems. You mentioned the midterms, but I wouldn't just, you know, chalk it up to, you know, this automatically has to result in economic pain, because it doesn't. There are policies that can be pursued that are in the national interest, both economically and from a foreign policy perspective.
I think most people would say if we're going to do infrastructure spending, we do it at home. And we've got highways, roads, bridges. We have people who are willing to work and do those things. And if we use that money to invest it here at home, I think we'd have a better outcome. And we had a jobs and infrastructure program that this president pulled back on, that he inherited from President Biden, that he decided he did not want to do anymore. And that sort of domestic spending, I think, would go a lot farther.
Yeah, unfortunately, that particular bill was a ton of wasted money. But, you know, I just don't see them as being mutually exclusive. I think that we could do both. I think roads and bridges and buildup of national defense all go hand in hand.
Let me ask you out there, what story are you following most closely and why? 888-477-9499, email studio2@whyy.org. I want to return to something you said earlier, Mustafa. You said that we're relearning this hard lesson over and over again, is that we try to intervene, we have these asymmetric conflicts in the Middle East, and it always goes poorly. And you said, we're not learning our lesson. I'm paraphrasing. I guess I thought we were starting to learn our lesson in the sense that Trump campaigned against the war in Iraq, saying it was a huge mistake. That was one of the things that helped distinguish him from the Republican field 10 years ago.
Yep.
So are you saying that lesson, it looked like we were learning, we are not indeed learning, or is it still moving in that direction? It's just sort of like linear progression.
We have not learned. I believe we have not learned that lesson unless there's something into which Terry mentioned. There's something in the security threat assessment that we have not seen. Even then, I would say that we have not learned that lesson because it doesn't work in that part of the world. It's just one of the things that were happening right now.
But are the politics around it changing, I guess, is what I'm asking, because even if Trump has made this decision to, let's say, start this war.
Yeah.
That the next president, the next administration, will be even more loath to engage in that region.
I hope that they are, because what does success or victory look like in that part of the world? You mentioned, and we can get into it, the asymmetrical tactics that Iran is using right now. Where Iran leaves this and they're not obliterated is a win for them.
Right.
It's a talking point for them. It's a win for them. They stood up to the United States. Like, that's not, you know, something that typically happens. And so I can't imagine that future presidential administrations will look at what happened here and say, I want to do that again. I'm hopeful that does not happen. Yeah.
Do you think interventionist strategies, Terry, will still continue to be about as appealing as they've been in the past for future administrations? Or is this conflict potentially moving us even further in that direction of having a more isolationist foreign policy?
I think that there are a lot of dangers with isolationist foreign policy. I put myself in the foreign policy sort of hawk category, not necessarily as a neoconservative in the Iraq sort of Bush war sense, but more in the Lindsey Graham vein, where, you know, it's really important for us, the peace through strength concept, the projecting American strength, protecting American interests
overseas.
Will
this more damage the credibility of people who make
I don't think so. No, I mean, of course, there's a lot to be decided between now and then. But I think the thing to keep an eye on is the fledgling but soon to be emerging Republican presidential primary. You know, I think the watching the Vance Rubio dynamic is really fascinating. If you listen to Rubio's speech last week on communism and sort of the threat of the sort of domestic violence from the left. It was a fascinating speech, and I think that he is figuring a way to articulate the next generation version of what that kind of foreign policy would look like in today's world.
Sort of Hawk 2.0?
Yeah, probably Hawk like 12.0.
Yeah, sure.
And whereas, you know, Vance's instincts are obviously much more isolationist. So I think that's the thing to keep an eye on. I just, you know, fundamentally, when you look at the threats that exist around the globe and you look at the relative weakness of the various international institutions and structures, I don't think we have a whole lot of we don't have a whole lot of options. Like, we don't get to choose. We don't get to be isolationists without there being some pretty severe consequences.
Yeah. And by the way, I want to remind you, our listeners, our phone lines are open. What story are you following most closely and why? The number to call is 888 877-499-9499. The email is studio2@whyy.org. And for folks watching on Facebook or YouTube, you can put your comments in the chat. We actually have a caller, Joseph from Mount Airy, on the line. Joseph, you're on Studio 2. What's your question or comment?
My comment as a Muslim, I'm totally against this war. I don't care what Terry says. See, people, see, that's why this stuff keeps happening, Sherry and Abby, and to your guests, Mustafa and Terry, because people don't pay attention to from history. The United States started all this stuff without Israel, number one. Number two, go back to 1953 when Iran, also known as Persia, elected Mohammed Morsi, the democratically elected leader, because he didn't kiss the United States behind. They overthrew him and put the evil Shah of Iran in there and stuff. And you find these cases over and over again. They caused trouble, and it caused innocent life with George Bush being in jail right now, the second Bush, when they lied about Saddam having weapons of mass destruction. More and more people getting wise to that now. That's why you see all these protests, because people getting tired of these lies, because they cost innocent lives in Iran, Iraq, everywhere on these lies, because they could have got this mentality that white makes right and right makes right.
Thank you, Joseph. Thank you. That's Joseph from Mount Airy. Very strong opinions about what you had to say. And so I want to shift gears a little bit, because we do have some other topics we want to talk about. And we want to talk about the Democratic Party a little bit. The big story that has been, you know, dominating headlines is the Maine senatorial race. Graham Platner's campaign has imploded. He stepped out of the race. And now Troy Jackson is very likely the presumptive nominee. It's not nailed down yet, but he is a progressive logger, former state legislator. And he has dominated their last-minute delegate conventions.
Yeah.
Just wanted to get each of your takes on the Maine situation, and also why you think this race has become such a bellwether nationally. And Mustafa,
yeah, we'll
you
start
ready?
There.
Go
yeah,
ahead.
We'll start there. So there, for Democrats to retake control of the Senate, it's almost impossible to do without Maine. So they need to defeat Susan Collins and have a Democrat in that seat. So starting with that, that's sort of the math there. It seems as if State Senator Troy Jackson has at least passed the vetting test, which was a problem with Graham Platner. I would say to you, and for we could spend the entire show talking about Graham Platner, I mean, these were problematic from the beginning, and people were willing to look over some things that he said, things that he wears on his body, relationships that he's had in the past, to say that that's more important than winning. And we still have to get to a point where character matters the most. And I think we found that out, that his character didn't meet the standards of what the people of Maine are looking for. He wasn't properly vetted. You can't build a candidate in a lab. You have to understand where people are coming from and what they're doing. And I think that's what they're trying to get done
now. And Troy Jackson had actually, he had endorsed Graham Platner.
Yes, he
has
did.
Come out and said that, you know, Graham Platner lied to us all.
Mm-hmm.
And now he's the very likely going to be the guy. There's going to be a debate later this week.
He could be the guy. Like I said, he's been in the public eye for quite some time, so I don't think there are any secrets about him. I think he does have a record that can speak for itself. And he'll have to make the case to the voters of Maine about why they should choose him over Susan, over the other primary candidates, and then ultimately in the fall. But I think Democrats are learning that character still matters. And that's going to be first and foremost in their minds as they try to find the right candidate.
And your take on this, Terry?
I mean, obviously, Graham Platner was an underwhelming human being, to be kind. But at the end of the day, Susan Collins is not to be underestimated.
Mm-hmm.
Democrats are, I think they got themselves a little giddy when they saw poll numbers that I think were sort of a mirage in the desert. And fundamentally, Troy Jackson's problems are going to be his policies. Mm-hmm. I mean, Medicare for All would cost 60% of GDP. So 60% of every dollar in the federal budget would have to go out the door just to prop up a program that, quite frankly, is not that impressive to begin with. And there are a few people that understand the people of Maine and can articulate that message in a way that is accessible to the people of Maine than Susan Collins. And so it's about defending the policies and articulating how the policies would actually work in a time of a lot of strife and anxiety that I think is going to be a problem. And I was choking the stuff out of the lobby. Like, I was like, listen, brother, I've been there. I was like, you know, the Republican Party has gone through these kinds of pains, right? As we go through this massive political realignment and the coalitions try to figure out what's the dominant faction and what's the not dominant faction and who's in the under the tent and who's not allowed under the tent. And I think the Biden administration basically just deferred the pain. Mm-hmm. It deferred the pain for 5 or 6 years because I think these issues are not new in the Democratic Party.
What are the issues? Like, what are the fault lines that you see?
Well, we see it in the city, right? I mean, we saw it in the third congressional primary campaign for the Democratic Party in the city. Is, you know, Chris Rabb and the folks in that group have a very different view about both the role of government and the direction of the Democratic Party than a lot of sort of traditional mainline city Democrats that, you know, used to run Democratic City Committee. It's just a parallel battle that's going on at the national level. And I think what Biden was able to do, and part of the reason why Biden, I think, was the safe candidate for despite all of his issues, he was the safe choice for Democrats in 2020 was because he didn't rock the boat, right? It was sort of like, this guy looks and sounds moderate, but ultimately he wasn't really the one making a lot of the decisions in the administration. Yeah. You had much more progressive forces and senior sort of political and policy decision maker. So everybody got what they wanted.
He did. He delayed the day of reckoning.
Yeah, and so here we are.
This is the reckoning.
This is the reckoning. He did.
And speaking of one of the issues dividing the party right now is what the American view should be toward Israel and aid for Israel. There was this legislative proposal that would have ended U.S. aid for Israel. It did not pass. It didn't come close to passing. However, about half of Democrats in the U.S. House voted for it. What do you take away from that vote, Mustafa?
We were talking about this outside. There's huge shift in the last few years. The vote, it's went from symbolic to almost meaningful to some point will actually have an impact on what's happening. And not only that, but you'll have to defend your vote. You'll have to say why you did or why you didn't moving forward for re-election or for what have you.
Do you see that as a permanent change, a reactionary change in the moment? Do you think there's a permanent realignment happening within a large part of the Democratic Party on whether or not the U.S. should support Israel militarily and diplomatically?
Yeah, it shift now feels permanent.
You think it feels permanent?
It feels permanent. There will still be some moderate Democrats who feel opposite, who feel otherwise. But right now, with the way the numbers jump by threefold over the last few years, it feels like a permanent change in how Democrats feel about Israel. Yeah.
And do you think that we will kind of settle? I'm just asking you from sort of inside the party. Do you think we'll settle at a place similar to what this vote was, where about half of Democrats feel we should continue to support Israel, about half say we shouldn't? Or will it become like other issues where essentially it's going to be a litmus test for being a Democrat?
I think it's becoming the new litmus test, which is quite unusual because just Democrat city policies has no real bearing. We talked about this a couple of months ago, but for some reason it seems to resonate with people about how they feel that their government leader should be. It is a litmus test more than anything else. It is not actually policy implementation at this point now. It's just sort of how do people feel about the state of Israel. And that's how.
So you see it becoming like an issue, like abortion.
It feels that way. Yeah, it feels that way. Yeah,
it'll move in that direction over time.
Yeah, like this sort of how do you feel about gun safety? How do you feel about abortion? How do you feel about women's rights? Like it'll be one of those core issues, and how
and the orthodox position will be to be not supportive of aid for Israel.
That is where the trend is shifting. Right
you agree
now.
With that? From the outside, I know you're not in the middle.
I think Mustafa's right. I mean, that's the trend that seems to be taking form. I think it's I guess it's too early to say what the politics of it all will be, but it's an unsettling trend to see that an issue that was an area where there was still some consensus across both sides where things could get done, fracturing the way it is. I mean, you saw Senator Fetterman's remarks last week where he said that's the red line for him, right? If he's going to leave the Democratic Party, it's probably going to be over that issue. So a lot of Democrats probably want to boot him out anyway. But you see, to have a sitting senator say that, it sort of crystallizes the issue. But I'll also say, Avi, like, it's in some ways the other issues like banning the Senate, eliminating the Electoral College, have broader implications and are even more unsettling than that.
We will have more on that issue and others on the other side of this break. We'd love to hear from you. What's the big issue in your mind right now? What story are you following most closely and why? 888-477-9499, studio2@whyy.org. Don't go anywhere. This is Studio 2 on WHYY.
Welcome back to Studio 2 here on WHYY. I'm Cherry Gray.
I'm Avi Wolfman-Arendt. Today on the show, we're breaking down the biggest national headlines with guests from either side of the aisle.
Yeah, with us in studio, we have Mustafa Rashid, President and CEO of Bellevue Strategies, and Terry Tracy, founder of Broad and Liberty and CEO of Fideri News Network.
We're asking you, what story are you following most closely and why? Our number is 888-477-9499. Our email is studio2@whyy.org. If you're on YouTube or Facebook, you can leave a comment in the chat. Denise is following the midterm elections from a few different perspectives. I'm following my old beat of Bucks County, Denise says, because the Brian Fitzpatrick, Bob Harvey race seems to have split the unions there. Yeah. Andreas wants to know about the impact of the FIFA World Cup on Philadelphia and when Lemon Hill will get back to normal. Andreas, it'll happen. And MJ says Trump is trying to steal another election. And on that point, let's get to election security.
Yeah, I mean, election security continues to be an issue in national politics. Republicans are arguing for stronger voter identification than citizenship, while Democrats emphasize protecting voter access. And so Trump gave a big, you know, speech last week. A lot of folks says it was a nothing burger, nothing new learned. You know, just your thoughts. And Mustafa, we'll start with you. Yeah. Your thoughts on this election security issue. Will it become a defining issue in the midterm?
The president wants it to be a defining issue. As a matter of fact, since he won his first election in 2016, he's been criticizing elections. Even the ones that he wins, he says they're cheating or other things that are happening. I think the attempt here is to color this election, to sow mistrust into this election, because most, by and large, most people are feel that elections are safe and secure. There have been dozens, if not more, of reviews and studies of the 2020 election, the one that the president seems to be fixated on, that was one of the more safe and secure elections in our lifetime. Voter ID isn't actually a real issue. 83% of adults, including 71% of Democrats, are good with voter of some form of voter identification. The issue here is the president wants government, federal government ID, which is a passport or birth certificate, which are not easily accessible for everyone. And he just doesn't have the votes for this to pass in the Senate.
And we're talking about the Save America Act, Terry. You know, the president is trying to make the case by bringing out this data that everybody had already had access to. Your thoughts on this? And then, you know, with, you know, Mitch McConnell out.
Yes.
With the death of Lindsey Graham.
Yeah.
He doesn't have the votes to get this act passed. Your thoughts on this?
I mean, if you can just set sort of the Trump mania aside for his control for it, right? Like, so he's been talking about this for years. It makes people feel really strongly one way or the other. Just sort of control for that for a minute and say, if someone were to tell you that the Chinese were trying to hack into our election systems, does that really sound so crazy to you? Because it doesn't sound that crazy to me. And if you said, as a result, we have to make sure that we're not going to federalize elections, but there has to be some level of federal oversight, input, whatever, to make sure that these systems are strengthened and that the biggest threat to a federalized and decentralized election administration system is the fact that there are unique vulnerabilities in different jurisdictions all over the country based on the systems they use and how effective the people. This is not a monolithic debate. And that's the problem with it. If you read Senator Murkowski's op-ed in the Wall Street Journal yesterday about why she said she was going to vote no on the SAVE Act, I may not ultimately agree with her outcome, but I think the argument she made was a sound one. What she basically said was, I support the objectives of this legislation. It is the right thing to do. The problem is the timing and the mechanics that are in here. And she spoke to specific dynamics in Alaska, which is obviously a state where people are massively spread out, and there's six election offices in the entire state, in a state twice the size of Texas. She's like, people can't get, they have to fly there just to show the document that you have to prove. She's like, I'm not against it, but we have to figure out tactically how this happens. And so when you start to think about that level of detail and you think about 50 individual states and tens of thousands of counties across the country, all of whom have a role in administering elections, I think that it's reasonable to say, how do you get the SAVE Act to address the top line concerns that are really very legitimate and then sort of deputize timing and implementation with oversight in a way that ultimately doesn't wind up disenfranchising.
And maybe this
people.
Bill needs to be worked on, right? But at the same time, we can't forget the fact that the president and this administration has made major cuts to agencies within the federal government that would deal with elections.
Yep, and they're threatening more.
And have been threatening more. If this is really a concern, why not shore up some of these agencies?
Yeah, there are, to Terry's point, there are over 10,000 counties, voting counties across the United States. So trying to have the SAVE Act be as an umbrella for all of them is just virtually impossible, especially at this late date. There are some states who do exclusive voting by mail, Oregon and Colorado. They've been doing it for a long time. And part of what the SAVE Act would do is what the president's saying is it would ban voting by mail. So there are things that are in place now that are safe and secure. There are paper trails that work that the president wants to get rid of. And I think that part of the role of this is to sow mistrust into the system so that if his party doesn't win, he can say that, you know, it was cheated.
Yeah. And I know you're saying you want to control for the Trump effect here, Terry, but it is hard to do that for many people when the person pushing this policy proposal most loudly, most aggressively is also falsely claiming the 2020 election was stolen. I mean, how can I trust that person to put this policy into place?
Well, let me disagree with you a little bit there. That was for the purposes of making the point. Like, I'm not suspending that, right? So all I'm saying is, like, people shut down when he starts talking about it.
I see. You wanted to get us into that intellectual argument, which I respect. Right. I want to say.
But also, he's not wrong. So let me just.
Not wrong about what?
About the problems in the 2020 election. And I have firsthand knowledge
that it was stolen? That he won?
In 2020, when Mark Zuckerberg poured tens of millions of dollars in the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania, we broke this story. It became a national story. All of the money went to blue states, and it was under the – or blue counties in the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania. And it was under the guise of sort of, you know, pandemic-era election administration. And the reality was none of the money – until it was found out the money was coming, not a dime was going to a red county. It was a get-out-the-vote operation for blue counties in Pennsylvania. It was the private financing of election administration. It was a real problem. Tom Wolf – signed and the Republican legislator at the time ultimately banned private financing of election because of this very issue in Pennsylvania.
Which they should.
Right? So there were irregularities all over the country just like that. Now, is it as it was stolen? I don't know. But when you're using private money to fund a public service in only Democrat leaning counties, to me it's a problem. And so if you take that issue at scale, or even if it just tipped Pennsylvania, then was the election stolen? I don't know. Call it what you want, but it certainly wasn't fair. And so I think what the president – and I get his style turns a lot of people off. But the point that he is making is the administration of elections in our country need review, and there are unique vulnerabilities that have to be addressed.
But he's over here saying that, you know, hundreds of thousands of non-citizens voted. He's making claims with no proof, right? And with stuff that people have seen. And I was looking at some of the documents that were released. They're severely redacted, don't really support that. And so you wonder how this act, the Save America Act, how the data that he's putting out there actually supports even what you're talking about, Terry. How would that fix the problems that you even identify?
I don't believe that it does, Avi, to your point earlier, the 2020 election is the litmus test for Republicans. And we saw acting director of national security being asked during his interview process, was it 2020? And like, that is the litmus test. Yeah. President Trump views his favorability of you based on whether or not you think the 2020 election was stolen. That is the litmus test on the Republican side. That's the Israel support of Israel side for Republicans.
Let's bring in a caller. Yeah. This is Peter from Willow Grove. Mm-hmm. Peter, you're on the line. You're on Studio 2. What's your question or comment? What's on your mind?
Well, a couple things. One of the first ones that kind of irked me a little bit was that last gentleman who called in, I don't know if his name is Joseph or Jason or something, I was kind of upset that you guys didn't address any of his talking points. You kind of just laughed at him, and I thought that was kind of rude. I don't know why you did that. He had plenty of good speaking points. Oh, yeah, I heard a good chuckle, but that's not the point. The other point is, if we're going to be charging fees to get through the Strait of Hormuz, which is not our land, what's going to happen when Iran guides another country's boat into a mine? Who's going to get the blame for that?
Sorry, you want us to answer that question or just help me out here?
Yeah, because this is affecting our economy. You know, it's affecting my gas prices because he decided to interfere with the way the oil was flowing. And now if, say, we charge a fee for people to get through the Strait of Hormuz, correct? That's the deal that's going on right now?
Peter, we're not here to, we're asking you to ask a question for experts. I can't directly answer your question about a foreign policy concern. We're just moderating a conversation here.
Well, I thought that's what this whole show is about.
We're here having a roundtable conversation about the political topics.
Well, why didn't you have a conversation with that nice gentleman who called in earlier, and he had plenty of good speaking points, but you just basically said, okay, thanks for your opinion, bye. Well,
I could see if
we're asking people to tell us
we do that with all the calls, Peter,
but they're following.
So we're just asking for your opinion, what you think is the big topic of the day.
Yeah, and that was kind of a big deal to me because you didn't address what he said. All right, have a great day, guys.
Okay. It was a little confusing, but I think we treated Joseph fairly, and we thought he made a lot of fair points.
Laughing.
Let's bring in Kathy from Westchester on the line.
Good afternoon. Thank you for journalists who will fight back against this nonsense that Trump is still pushing about the 2020 election. And I will never forgive the Republican Party for letting him get away with this. The point here is that they want to affect the elections to go their way. And it is cynical and un-American for them to keep this up. And good for you for fighting back on it.
Thank you.
Thank you
Kathy
for that comment, Kathy.
And we should talk about ICE if we can.
Yeah, let's talk about ICE enforcement real quick before we wrap up the show. Two recent fatal shootings, one on July 7th in Houston, mm-hmm. the victim Lorenzo Salgado Araujo. Another one on July 13th in Biddeford, Maine. This time the victim, Joan Sebastian Duran Guerrero. Both killed by immigration enforcement agents. And still a lot of unanswered questions, mm-hmm. Mustafa, mm-hmm. about what exactly happened in these incidents. What is your major takeaway from both the incidents themselves, the killings themselves, but also the reaction to it?
Yeah, a tragedy that people lost their lives during a law enforcement operation. There's a lot of confusion about if they were targeting the right persons, if they had the right person, so that part certainly is a tragedy. It feels like stepped up enforcement over the mm-hmm. past couple of weeks that we, mm-hmm. After the tragic incidents in Minnesota, we stopped paying attention to it, or at least they were not happening. And now it feels like they're happening again. And you wonder, what is the purpose of it? And what are we trying to do? Are we making communities safe by killing civilian by these kind of killings? And I don't think that it does, and I certainly do not believe that is the intent of law enforcement to do this, but this keeps continuing to happen, and the federal government should take a pause again before implementing these policies.
Your reaction, Terry, to these latest killings? And also I would say that there was a report in the New York Times that the FBI is maybe not going to fully investigate these types of incidents moving forward. There was some pushback from the administration on that reporting, but your reaction both to the killings and then the administration's response to the killings.
I hate to sound like a broken record on this issue, but when you let 20 million people run across the border, this is unfortunately the kind of collateral damage that happens. I'm struck by the difference in the public reaction. Perhaps it's because, in the cases in Minnesota, there were American citizens, and in this case, the folks I don't believe were. Also, it seems that the immigration enforcement action by the administration has actually stepped up, but is operating more in the background, but more efficiently and more effectively since Mark Wayne Mullen took over as DHS secretary. It seemed like a lot of what was going on with former Secretary Christine Noem was sort of, there was like the performative politics aspect of it and showing up on TV commercials. And that sort of sensationalism, I think, really was unsettling when it was compounded with the realities of the way things were being implemented on the ground. But it seems like Secretary Mullen has his arms around how to get this done without creating a public outcry. And, the administration ran on this, Republicans ran on this, and they are delivering on their campaign promise. Of course, any human life lost is a tragedy. But I would say the same is the case for all of the folks that drowned in the Rio Grande or children that were mm-hmm. compromised on their way to a journey a couple years ago that really was an unfortunate one from the start.
Yeah. As we get ready to wrap up, we have about a minute and a half left in the show. Wanted to just ask you each, the latest polls give Democrats just a small lead on the generic congressional ballot. I just want to get each of you to give your take. If you're a Democrat, are you concerned that the lead is so small? And if you're a Republican, How are you feeling about this, given the unpopularity of the president right now? And
I'd say Democrats should be concerned by large. I think Democrats have – they've in individual races across the country where they have an opportunity to flip seats from red to blue, they've won – they've outperformed Trump prior years by like 12 to 14 points. So they – you know, if you're starting a race 12 to 14 points up, you should be good.
Three now. Yeah.
Correct. You should be good. But that – the only thing that's – when you look at polling right now, Democrats, their policies are just not really breaking through. Mm-hmm. In individual polls and in individual races, they seem to be doing well. But by and large, I just don't feel that Americans yet believe that Democrats have put forth a platform that's for that Americans understand.
And I'll give you the final 30 seconds. Go ahead.
In 2022, Republicans believe that the president's unpopularity was going to be enough to create a wave election. It wasn't. There were a number of unresolved questions about the Republican Party at the time. I think the same is now true for the Democrats in 2026. What was supposed to be a red wave was a red trickle. And I think that the you know, how unsettled the Democratic Party is, both ideologically and in terms of leadership, and frankly in terms of answering some of the questions about what happened during the Biden administration, will haunt them. And until they're resolved, here we are. It's a jump ball.
Thank you, Terry Tracy, founder of Broad and Liberty and CEO of Fidelity News Network, for your time today on Studio 2.
Thank you, guys.
And Mustafa Rashid, president and CEO of Bellevue Strategies, also appreciate your time today the program. Brian says, I'm watching the continuing abuse of power by ICE agents. Hugh from Coatesville says, I agree with caller Joseph. This is all because of Israel.
Yeah. Thank you so much to everybody who called in. Thank you to folks who wrote in and watched on Facebook and YouTube and listened in. We appreciate you. And of course, we got to say thank you to our producers, Debbie Builder, Hazel May, Brian, Paige Murray Besser, and Ben Abrams. Mike Schiffler is our visual producer, Diana Martinez and Tina Calique engineered today's show. Our executive producer is Kevin McCory.
From Studio 2 at WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Avi Wolfman-Arendt. We'll talk to you tomorrow.
And I'm Cherry Gregg. Thank you so much for joining us.